Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What is the cost of insisting that you are innocent? What is the cost of standing up to a system that doesn't have time to seriously consider the facts of your life and instead throws you into a boiling cauldron of violence, wild speculation, caught in a presumption of guilt? Claims of innocence are drowned out, but you hold on as time slips through your fingers. This hour, how a young boy's claim of innocence cost him 3 precious years of life and eventually became a death sentence in a system that has forgotten what justice is. Also, a story of how a family's desperate efforts to find their lost son became a quick and easy explanation for the Boston Marathon bombing. How suspicion of guilt defeats innocence when the internet cannot unsay its false accusations. We start, though, with a case of spectacular failure to protect the weak and a young 16-year-old boy determined to hold out for the truth.
It was weird from the first day I was in there. From the first day they put the handcuffs on me, it was weird for me. I mean, because I knew I didn't do it, and then I don't know this dude, and then I know that they're not, I felt like the police wasn't conducting their job correct. So I knew from the first day I was in there that everything was wrong. But it was hard. Knowing that for the whole 3 years was very hard. And then it came to the point when they offered me time served, and that's when it really got real, real stressful for me, because being in there for about 33 bumps, and you miss everything. Everything about being home, the fresh air, your family, certain events. You want to be home. And then when they give you an offer to go home right then and there, it's like, I want to go home, but then you know you didn't do it, so you don't want to take the plea and say that you do it. It's not right.
Khalif Browder told the officers that first questioned him when he was arrested in the spring of 2010 that he didn't do it, steal a backpack from an accuser who could not even recall accurately when he had been attacked. That's Khalif speaking there to the Huffington Post after spending more than 3 years at the Rikers Island Jail in New York awaiting trial. During that time, he never lost his resolve to maintain his innocence. He did lose hope, though, on a number of occasions.
I tried to resort to telling the correction officers that I wanted to see a psychiatrist or a counselor, something. I was telling them I need mental help because I wasn't feeling right. All the stress from my case, everything was just getting to me, and I just couldn't take it. I just needed somebody to talk to. I needed to just I just needed to talk and be stress free. But the correction officers, they didn't want to hear me out. Nobody wanted to listen. So when I tried to kill myself at one point, which was in 2012 March, at one point I tried to kill myself.
What did you do?
I had ripped my sheets on my I had ripped my bed sheets and made a noose out of it, and I had hung it to something that's on the ceiling, a light fixture, and I was about to jump. And the correction officers they opened my cell, and when I jumped, they grabbed me, they cut me down, they threw me on the bed, they had gave me a lot of punches, they stomped me on the bed, they took my sheets, my books, my covers, and they stomped me for about 2-3 trays straight.
So they punished you for this?
Yes.
They attacked you and punished you for this?
Yes.
Browder received a number of severe beatings, some that were caught on video. He spent hundreds of days in solitary confinement. Finally leaving Rikers in the spring of 2013 because his case was dismissed, he realized that the price for maintaining his innocence was to lose his childhood. Journalist Jennifer Gonerman wrote about Khalif's case and his struggles with mental health after his release in The New Yorker last October. Senator Rand Paul spoke about him on the campaign trail. Mayor Bill de Blasio here in New York cited his case in calling for reform at Rikers Island. Khalif even received personal help from Jay-Z and Rosie O'Donnell. He enrolled in community college, but he was clearly a scarred, lonely, and changed young man. His last suicide attempt succeeded last weekend at his mother's home in the Bronx. He was 22 years old. Joining us is Stanley Richards, former Rikers inmate who is now on the NYC Board of Corrections. Stan is also the senior vice president of the Fortune Society, an organization that aims to support successful reentry from prison and promote alternatives to incarceration. Stanley, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Everything went wrong here.
Absolutely. Khalif's situation is a situation that really identifies what's totally wrong with the system from the very beginning to the very end. Here's a young man, 16 years old, gets arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack and is given a $10,000 bail, first of all, and then prosecuted for 3 years and then dismissed, having the case dismissed. So this situation is so wrong in so many aspects. At the Fortune Society, we talk about the refining the system in terms of our policing strategies, in terms of our strategies in holding people accountable in incarceration, and about what we do to provide opportunities for people to change their lives. And Khalif's situation is just very, very sad.
So many people who are observers of Rikers and are critics of Rikers even say that this case is extreme for Rikers. How did Khalif get lost? How did his case continue to be delayed by prosecutors who would ask for a week and the delay would be for 6 weeks because the Bronx courts are so overloaded?
Yeah, and Khalif's situation, let me say, is not unique. There are many men and women who are incarcerated who have been on Rikers for very long times, fighting their cases, trying to protest their innocence, and they have to go through this brutal system, and it takes years to process cases in the Bronx, in the city, period. So his situation in terms of people fighting their cases is not unique. His situation is not unique in terms of the brutality of what goes on in jails in our city and in our country. It's just a reality.
Let me just ask you a question that was raised in at least one of the stories on Khalif. And that is, I've got two 16-year-olds. If I took one of them and put her in solitary confinement for 2 years in our home, I would be arrested and convicted very swiftly of a felony, and my child would be taken away from me. But Rikers can do that to a 16-year-old, and it's like, no big deal.
Well, now the Board of Corrections has changed the standards around solitary confinement. The Board of Corrections, which I'm a part of now, did rulemaking in January and implemented strict rules about the way in which Department of Corrections can implement punitive segregation. So now the Khalif situation will never happen again to someone else. We implemented rules that state people can only be in solitary confinement for 30 days. After 30 days, they have to be released back to general population for 7 days. Nobody could stay in punitive segregation for more than 60 days over a period of 6 months. So the Board of Corrections took steps to make sure that the Khalif situation never, ever happens again.
Although, let's look at this in detail. I mean, here's a guy who's arrested. There's a presumption of innocence, right? I mean,
he's
committed no crime as far as the system is concerned. He's just awaiting trial. Mm-hmm. All right. So no crime, presumption of innocence. He's in this jail. He looks at a guard wrong or gets into a fight with another inmate. There's no court that convicts him of bad behavior. They just can throw him in solitary confinement, a punishment that would probably exceed what he would get for the original crime that he's in there for. They can do that without any due process at all. I mean, he is so powerless. It reminds
Absolutely.
Me of Gitmo.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, the World Health Organization and the UN has determined that more than 15 days in solitary confinement is considered torture. And yet that is permitted to happen throughout our country in our jails and prisons. But one of the things that we've been doing as a board is really looking at that. Our role and our job as the Board of Corrections is to provide oversight and accountability to the department. I feel like the city council with Speaker Viverito, the mayor, and the commissioner we have in Department of Corrections, that we have the people behind the movement to do right by the men and women who are incarcerated and to really change the system.
Before we go, though, can you just take me into Rikers and give me a sense of what it's like or just your emotional reaction to a young man who goes in there, loses his childhood, and comes out a person damaged beyond repair who kills himself? Basically, the die was cast when he was released in 2013.
John, I went out to Rikers a couple of weeks ago, and I was an inmate out there. When I was out there, the feel of the building, the interactions between inmates and correction officers were totally different. Now you go into the jails. Every jail, it's so tense. From the moment you walk in, nobody has movement without correction officers. people are either dressed in uniform or they're dressed in clothes. And you can just see there's no sense of hope. There's no sense of life. There's no sense of anything is going to be different in my life. It's just a pool of hopelessness. And part of what we try to do at the Fortune Society is to provide perspective, provide hope, and provide people a foundation to build a new life. And in Rikers right now, it's not like that. It is just an intense, depressing situation.
It was a death sentence when those cops came over to question him on that street about a backpack that was stolen.
Absolutely.
By someone who couldn't even remember when it was stolen.
Absolutely. And I look at the judge, the district attorney, the Department of Correction. They all have responsibility for what ended up happening to Khalif. The fact that the judge gave him a $10,000 bail, the fact that the district attorney decided to prosecute him and hold him in jail for 3 years. What were they thinking about this young man, 16-year-old kid, accused of stealing a backpack? What were they thinking when they put him in Rikers Island? What were they thinking?
Stanley Richards, former Rikers inmate who's now on the New York City Board of Corrections, and he's the senior vice president of the Fortune Society, which helps inmates with their reentry process into society. Stanley, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
A new U.S. Senate will take a look at an old issue that will be part of the debate over the Pentagon's military policy bill for next year. It was back to the drawing board for New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand after she failed to get her proposed legislation to make sexual assault a crime that could no longer be shielded from within the chain of command last time around. She fell a few votes short of 60 votes to defeat a filibuster. And now this new Congress is a Republican majority. Senator Gillibrand spoke of the challenges ahead to take away Washington correspondent Todd Zwillich. Todd, does the senator believe that significant reform in the way sexual assault is handled within the military is possible this term?
Well, John, there was reform last year. Gillibrand says it hasn't gone nearly far enough. According to the Pentagon's own numbers, there were about 6,500 reported cases of sexual assault in fiscal 2014. Now, that's only about a quarter of the total, according to the Pentagon. So that real number is up around 24,000 incidents, most of them unreported. Now, there were reforms last year. Commanders can't overturn jury verdicts within the military anymore. It gives more victims more say over whether or not a perpetrator will be prosecuted, and it makes retaliation against the accuser a crime. Now, Gillibrand says that that last point, retaliation, has basically been unchanged, that more than over 60% of accusers say they were retaliated against in some form, whether by a superior or by peers or by the group, and that the retaliation part of the reforms have basically not worked. Gillibrand wants to take prosecution, the decision to prosecute an alleged sexual assault in the military, out of the chain of command, give it to an independent prosecutor within the military so that commanders aren't making this decision. Listen.
If you look at the data that has been studied by the RAND Corporation, 1 in 7 of these survivors were assaulted by someone within their chain of command. So if you expect the chain of command to have the level of transparency and accountability that's necessary, you're never going to solve this problem.
So Gillibrand believes the survivors are still vulnerable. What does the Pentagon believe? Are they lobbying against this, or are they supportive in some sense?
They're lobbying against this. The Pentagon put out its own report just last month. They said that the likelihood that an incident is reported is up. Reporting is still relatively rare. As I said, only 25% of cases do get reported. The Pentagon says that reported incidents, however, are down by 16%. They say they're making progress. And a lot of lawmakers would agree with that as well. Listen to Senator Ron Johnson. He's up for re-election. He's a Republican from Wisconsin. He voted against Senator Gillibrand's reforms last year. But for some other reforms that were passed, and I asked him if he's inclined to vote with Gillibrand this year.
You take this type of discipline, you take this thing out of the line of command, they're no longer accountable. And so let's, at a minimum, allow the reforms that were enacted last year, time to be enacted, and so we can really evaluate it. If they're not working, we can revisit it. But for the time being, let's give those reforms a chance.
How much time do Republicans believe they need? And does the president have a vote here? I mean, is he on one side or the other of this issue?
Well, the president certainly has a vote, and the president used these words last year along with the military commanders. He said that we're on the clock. They said give it a year for reforms to take hold. And Gillibrand points to the fact that after a year, those retaliations are still high. And incidentally, not a single case of prosecution for retaliation in the intervening year, John, under the old reforms. And the president certainly has a vote in this. He made some changes unilaterally as commander in chief. But Kirsten Gillibrand has been very critical of the military brass and of President Obama in this regard, saying that, look, if you leave commanders in place here, they've shown that they're just not going to be able to make effective, impartial decisions about who should be prosecuted. Listen.
I believe the president should show greater leadership. I believe he should make this change. It's within his authority. His Secretary of Defense last year took the decision-making about whether to overturn a jury verdict out of the chain of command. This is a similar technical legal decision that shouldn't rest with untrained commanders who are not lawyers, who are not prosecutors, their main mission isn't to decide criminal cases. They're supposed to be training and leading the troops. If they can focus on their core mission and have professionals do this job, I think outcomes will be better.
Have the leadership in the Senate done the math here? Has Senator Gillibrand done the math here? Have you done the math here? What's the chance of this succeeding?
Yeah, the answer to all three of those questions is yes. And the votes are interesting on this, John. The leadership in the Senate, you asked, McConnell and Reid, Republican and Democratic leadership, are both with Kirsten Gillibrand on this issue. That means she's probably going to get a vote this week. As early as today, it could be tomorrow, it could be early next week on this defense authorization bill. She has some Republicans with her, libertarians like Ted Cruz running for president, Rand Paul running for president, both with Gillibrand on this. She says these are the types of Republicans who don't feel that they have to defer to the Pentagon when they talk about military policy. But the leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican and Democrat, and all of the Republicans and many of the Democrats on the Armed Services Committee, although not all, are not with Gillibrand on this. You ask if it's an uphill climb for her. It's a vertical climb. The likelihood of Gillibrand getting her way on new reforms is very, very low. She knows it. It's because of the elections from last year and because the numbers just aren't there. Listen to Gillibrand's own assessment.
Last year, unfortunately, we had 55 votes, very close to the 60 needed to overcome the filibuster. Unfortunately, we were filibustered. We had more than a majority of the Senate supporting this reform, which should be enough. But because we were filibustered, we needed to reach 60. Unfortunately, we've lost 10 of those senators through retirements and through the elections. So I have to introduce this issue and have meetings with new senators who maybe have never looked at this issue or studied this issue or know much about it.
You know, I have a filibuster question. Does anybody stand out front and say, I'm going to block this? Or is this filibuster just procedural and nobody's name gets attached to blocking this, even though a majority is with Gillibrand?
Yeah, it's probably the latter. It's not the type of filibuster where somebody stands out there and gets on TV and rails against this. Usually, senators make agreements on lists of amendments and everybody agrees to do it at a 60-vote threshold because they know that you could require 60 anyway and take up just a lot more time. Listen, Gillibrand has flipped one Republican, Senator Mark Kirk from Illinois, who's up for re-election and is a veteran Navy reservist himself, is switching his vote from no last year to yes this year. But otherwise, as you heard, she said she lost 10 from last year, John. It's likely she's going to lose this time around.
A vertical climb there for Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So let's try and envision what a candidate debate with all 366 or so real candidates would look like. It would have to be some kind of massive Twitter chat or something. Nick Corsetti, a political news reporter for our partner, The New York Times, has done some research and used his imagination to put these candidates on the same stage, so to speak. Nick, what does it look like?
Well, it looks pretty crowded, and believe it or not, I woke up this morning and I checked the FEC website again, and we're actually at 375 by now.
I knew it. I knew it. I knew that number wouldn't hold. So rising like a bullet. Give me some names here, Nick.
So you have everyone from simple names like John Green Ferguson of Texas to the really long names like HRM Caesar St. Augustine de Bonaparte, Emperor of the United States of Turtle Island. That actually fits all on his FEC form and is his official candidate name.
Is he a new candidate? Has he tried before?
Yeah, he's actually given it a shot every cycle since 1996. He recently took his platform to YouTube. He streams under the name Reality Supreme Being. I'm guessing his full candidate name didn't fit in the YouTube character count. But he'll get on there and he'll give his speeches into a microphone box. He wears like a straw hat, sunglasses, big orange suspenders, and kind of just talks about what's on his mind. Sometimes it's civil rights. Other times it's a battle he had with Microsoft support group. I think he still has a Hotmail address.
Does anybody come to the ring here with clear metrics of support using social media?
You could maybe say that Thomas Keister, who's running under the banner of the Marijuana Party, has some measure of support. His Twitter account has 25,000 plus followers. And Lincoln Chafee, who's running for president on the Democratic side, he's the former Rhode Island senator and governor, only has 16,000. So, I mean, you can make of that what you will. Mr. Keister follows 24,000, so there may be some Twitter etiquette at play where, you know, if someone follows you, you follow them back because you feel like you should. But he certainly has at least a noticeable following on Twitter, more than me.
Any evidence that some of these footnote candidates here are actually doing campaigning?
There's one who's he loves to crash other events. His name is Vermin Supreme, and he has been a presence in New Hampshire for a couple of cycles. In 2012, he ran on the Democratic Party side, even though President Obama was up for re-election, so there wasn't much of a contest there, but he still was able to get 833 votes. And this year, he's been out on the trail. Back in April, he crashed a Rand Paul event, which I believe was right after Senator Paul announced his candidacy. And he stayed outside the VFW with his trademark rubber boot as a hat. He had a tiger print kind of pajamas on his back and a big bowl of lollipops that he was handing out to voters, along with bumper stickers that said Vermin Supreme for president.
Vermin Supreme, according to the website, is the only candidate who supports fully funding time travel research in order to go back and kill Hitler before he was born. The only candidate who makes mandatory toothbrushing his signature issue. All right, this person doesn't seem terribly serious, but he does seem to have a lot of free time. Any actual serious candidates who are in this footnote category?
Actual candidates?
Yeah. I mean, serious. You know, I mean, like, they want to change something. Like this John Green Ferguson fellow.
Well, yeah, he's running. His platform calls for recycling every piece of trash in the country. And he does have a campaign website. It also doubles as a website for his company, which I think is Glows ABC. And they seem to be a contractor for green living and green hardware and things like that. But he at least does have some kind of platform that he's running on. It's very environmental.
Any favorites for you personally?
Well, my favorite, at least that I've come across, has been, and I might not pronounce this right, but Princess Kajia M. Jacob from Brau. She's from California, running as a Revolutionary Party candidate, but her candidate committee name includes a marriage proposal, and I'll just read the committee name in full for you right now. It's from one alien to another, .. Lil Wayne, Dwayne Michael Carter Jr., quote, President Carter, will you marry me? I am a god, with a few exclamation points and a smiley face to cap it off.
One of the now 375 candidates running for president, Nicholas Corestaniti, political news reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much, Nick.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We had the best time at your party. The wife and I, thank you very much. We had the best time at your party. The wife and I, thank you very much.
Finally this hour, how can one claim innocence when the internet decides you are guilty and there is no way to defend yourself? In the spring of 2013, a college student named Sunil Tripathi went missing. His family used every resource available, including the power of social media, to search for Sunil. In the beginning, the outpouring of support and love was a comfort to a heartbroken family.
The Facebook part and social media part was absolutely uplifting. When we did a posting and we saw a lot of response, you know, it carried us. It carried us.
Sunil was still missing and his face all over the internet 4 weeks later when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. In the frenzy to find the killers, Sunil's name was tossed around and then speculation became a suspicious lead on Twitter and Reddit. Eventually, it made its way into the mainstream media.
Very quickly bounced back up out of Twitter and into blogs and news sites and other places as everyone tried to capitalize on the traffic that they knew would come from having that name in a headline really quickly.
But after only a few days, Sunil's name was replaced by the real killers in the Boston bombing. The damage was done, though, and all of the warmth of people searching for lost Sunil had been wiped out by the speculation about a guilty Sunil. And so when Sunil was found to have killed himself shortly after he went missing, it was a dual tragedy this family faced. And that dual tragedy is the subject of the new film Help Us Find Sunil. Neil Broffman is the director of the film and got exclusive access to this story. Sangeeta Tripathi is Sunil's big sister.
So when you're searching for somebody and you need the help of the community and the world, you use every avenue you get. And I think the events of Boston, as we've talked about in the film, really show that there's both a power and a really big source of challenge that can come with reaching out to others. In the 2 days after that trauma, we actually were able to use that same amount of energy and beauty that was taken negatively that night in an incredible way. And in the span of 2 days, over 10,000 people liked our Facebook page. Over 500 people wrote messages on their hands and sent them back to our family and continued to engage in the search. And so what's very important is that there was a trauma of looking for my brother. There was a trauma of the way in which social media and traditional media caused a lot of harm in one night by moving a lot of lies. And then there was an incredible power that's very important not to get lost that actually was used to help continue searching for my brother.
What was Sonny like? What would I think of him if he was sitting here talking to me? What impression would I get?
My brother is an incredibly gentle, quiet and consistent and thoughtful person. Kind of the essential ingredient in making any recipe, right? In our family, you can't make cake without flour. You know, you can't make cake without eggs. He was this part of our family and of his own group of friends, so it was very important and special.
How aware were you of his emotional cycles?
So mental health is a really big challenge among many young people. Suicide is the second leading cause of death of teens. And most of those deaths, many of those deaths are not things that are expected by anybody. Every young person struggles, and most people don't quite know how deep those struggles are. When we were searching, our family had to speak to people all day, every day, in every convenience store, on every street for 39 days. And I cannot tell you the number of people who gave us hugs and say, I know my brother, my son, my daughter, my niece, my neighbor. Mental health is a really big challenge for everyone. And the really scary part is no one really knows how much people are struggling until bad things often happen.
There's the shot of him walking away on a security camera that appears in your film. That's a very ghostly picture. That's the last time we see him. But yet there's so much of him in this film that happens after that moment. As a filmmaker, what was your challenge here?
The challenge is to be fair to the story, be fair to the family, be fair to Sunil, and to tell the story in a way which is not sensationalistic. That was all done the night of the misidentification. After the bombs went off in Boston, you have people who are starting to speculate, you know, through platforms like Reddit, crowdsourcing the investigation, sharing information.
People could do searches and go, hey, I'm a detective.
That's right. And this was encouraged. And so by the time on Thursday when the FBI had their press conference and released the photographs, it was already churning. And so all these things were said. And to do a course correction and explain, to try to step back and look and see how did something like this happen, and yet then go beyond and say, well, these are all the things that were said, but this is who this real person was. And this is his family, and this is what they went through. That's a big challenge.
You worked for the networks. right, Neil?
Yes. I worked for CNN for a long time.
And you've experienced the news feeding frenzy from the other side of the desk before, right? Or the other side of the camera.
That's right. But, you know, in a situation like this, it's very different today because journalists are required to operate in two universes. One, like the one that we're on right now on the radio. And then you've got this other mysterious world of social media where reporters are expected to tweet, participate in conversations, start conversations. And I think this is where it becomes very dangerous because whereas you would never say something without a proper source, for some reason on that night, people were able to use sources like Omar 2000, 3000, you know, these anonymous, who are these people?
What was it like for your parents to see this unfamiliar sort of internet world turn on Sunil and turn seemingly on them in an instant with no truth attached to it?
It is as anybody would imagine it to be. This is horrible, right? It is horrible for somebody's name to be flying around falsely. Sunil's story is particularly tragic and it's particularly painful to our family. And part of why I choose now to continue engaging with the media is to continue to raise awareness for everyone to remember not just to accuse social media or traditional media, but for every single person to realize how much power their voice has or their little tweet or their type.
To be responsible
and
for
to realize that there is a human being on the other side of the screen.
In the end, you discovered what happened to Sunil. How would you describe the state of your family now and what it was like to learn those final facts?
It's really hard to know that we as a family and we as a community and we as a world kind of weren't enough to be able to save my brother. And one of the first thing that goes when people are struggling is their connection to each other, right? People pull back, they get disconnected, they feel isolated. And it's at that moment that it's most important that in all of our efforts, whether they're at kind of the macro media level or the super micro level of a Facebook message or a hello or a text message, that we be loving and we continue to reach out to each other. Because when we either attack each other or pull back entirely, we leave people We really leave people.
Neil and Sangeeta, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The film is called Help Us Find Sunil. It won the Brooklyn Audience Award at the Brooklyn Film Festival this past weekend and will be distributed by Film Buff this fall. And here's something to take with you today. Let us gather in a flourishing way with Sun Luz Grain's Abriendo Los Cantos, the bilingual poetry of Chicano writer Juan Felipe Herrera. The Library of Congress today names Herrera the next poet laureate, the nation's highest honor in poetry. That's all for today, but if you want to take the takeaway with you, all you have to do is subscribe to our podcast. Find us at iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. A great way to stay up on the news and to stay in the conversation. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.